they were able to cross. German Staatspolizei had held back civilian traffic and allowed the armored units to pass. But this changed when Soviet artillery began bursting in the air close to the river. The Russians had hoped it would impede traffic, and it did. Civilians who had been late to follow orders to leave their homes now paid for their error. The artillery did scant damage to fighting vehicles, but thoroughly wrecked civilian cars and trucks. In minutes, the streets of Alfeld were jammed with disabled and burning cars. People left them, braving the fire to run for the bridges, and the tanks trying to make their way to the river found their way blocked. Their only escape was over the bodies of innocent civilians, and even when ordered to proceed, the drivers shrank from it. Gunners rotated their turrets to face over the rear and began to engage the Russian tanks now entering the town. Smoke from burning buildings wafted across everyone's field of view. Cannon fired at targets glimpsed for a moment. Rounds went wild, and the streets of Alfeld turned into a slaughterhouse of soldiers and non-combatants. "There they are," Sergeyev pointed. Three highway bridges spanned the line. Alexeyev started to give orders, but they weren't necessary. The regimental commander already had his radio microphone keyed and directed a battalion of tanks with infantry support to proceed up the west bank, following the same route, still relatively open, that the Americans had used. The American fighting vehicles on the far side of the river opened fire with missiles and their light cannon, killing a half-dozen tanks, and the remainder of the regiment engaged them with direct fire, while Alexeyev personally called down artillery on the hilltops. In Alfeld, the battle had come to a bloody standstill. The German and British tanks took up positions at intersections largely hidden from view by wrecked cars and trucks, and backed toward the river slowly as they fought to give the civilians time. The Russian infantry tried to engage them with missiles, but too often debris lying in the streets tore the flight control wires, causing the missiles to fall out of control and explode harmlessly. Russian and Allied artillery fire churned the town to rubble. Alexeyev watched his troops advancing toward the first bridge. South of him, the commander of the lead regiment swore at his losses. More than half his tanks and assault vehicles had been destroyed. Victory was within his grasp, and now his troops had been stopped again by impassable streets and murderous fire. He saw the NATO tanks pulling slowly back, and, enraged that they were escaping, called in for artillery. Alexeyev was surprised when the artillery fire shifted from the center of the town to the riverfront. He was shocked when he realized that it was not tube artillery fire, but rockets. As he watched, explosions appeared at random over the riverfront. Then rounds began exploding in the river in rapid succession. The rate of fire increased as more and more launchers were trained on the target, and it was already too late for him to stop them. The farthest bridge went first. Three rockets landed at once, and it came apart. Alexeyev watched in horror as over 100 civilians fell into the churning water. His horror was not for the loss of life. He needed that bridge. Two more rockets landed on the center bridge. It did not collapse, but the damage it took was serious enough to prevent tanks from using it. "The fools? Who was responsible for this?" He turned to Sergeyev. "Call up the engineers. Get bridging units and assault boats to the front. They have absolute priority. Next, I want every surface-to-air missile and anti-air gun battery you can find. Anyone who gets in their way will be shot. Make sure the traffic control officers know this. Go!" The Soviet tanks and infantry had reached the only surviving bridge. Three infantry vehicles raced to the far side and were taken under fire by the Belgians and Americans as they raced to cover. A tank followed. The T-80 rumbled across, got to the far side, and exploded from an impacting missile. Another followed, then a third. Both reached the west bank. Then a British chieftain emerged from behind a building and followed the Soviet tanks across. Alexeyev watched in amazement as it ran right between the two Soviet vehicles, neither of which saw it. An American missile ran just behind it and plowed into the ground, raising a cloud of dirt and dust. Two more chieftains emerged at the bridgehead. One exploded from a point-blank shot by a T-80. The other fired back, killing the Russian tank a second later. Alexeyev remembered a tale from his boyhood of a brave peasant on a bridge as the British tank engaged and killed two more Soviet tanks before succumbing to a barrage of direct fire. Five more Soviet vehicles raced across the bridge. The general lifted his headset and dialed up 8th Guards Army Headquarters. "This is Alexeyev. I have a company of troops across the line. I need support. We have broken through. Repeat, we have broken through the German front. I want air support and helicopters to engage NATO units north and south of Bridge 439. I need two regiments of infantry to assist with the river crossing. Get me support and I might have my division across by midnight." "You'll get everything I have. My bridging units are on the way." Alexeyev leaned against the side of his BMP. He unbuckled his canteen and took a long drink as he watched his infantry climb the hills under fire. Two complete companies were across now. Allied fire was now attempting to destroy the remaining bridge. He had to get at least a full battalion across if he wanted to hold this bridgehead for more than a few hours. "I'll get the bastard," he promised himself, "who fired on my bridges." "Boats and bridges are en route, Comrade General," Sergeyev reported. "They have first priority, and the sector traffic control officers have been informed. Two SAM batteries are starting this way, and I found three mobile AA guns 3 kilometers off. They said they can be here in 15 minutes.
"Good."
Alexeyev trained his binoculars on the far bank. "Comrade General, our infantry carriers are amphibious. Why don't we swim them across?"
"Look at the river bank, Vanya."
The general handed his glasses over. As far as he could see, the far side was all set with stone and concrete to prevent erosion. It would be difficult, if not impossible, for the tracked vehicles to climb that.
"Damn the Germans for that!
Besides, I wouldn't want to try that in anything less than regimental strength. That bridge is all we have, and it can't last very long. With the best of luck, we won't have any assault bridges in place for several hours. The troops on the far side are on their own for at least that long. We'll run as many troops and vehicles across the bridge as we can, then reinforce with infantry assault boats as soon as they arrive. The book calls for this sort of crossing to be made in assault boats, under cover of darkness or smoke. I don't want to wait for night, and I need the guns to fire live shells, not harmless ones. We must break the rules, Vanya. Fortunately, the book allows for that also. You have performed well, Ivan Mikhailovich. You are now a major. Don't thank me. You've earned it."
Stornoway, Scotland. "We didn't miss them by much. If we'd seen them 5 minutes sooner, we could have taken a few out. As it was..."
The Tomcat pilot shrugged. Toland nodded. The fighters had orders to remain outside Soviet radar coverage.
"You know, it's a funny thing. There were three of them flying a nice, tight formation. I had them on my TV system from 50 miles away. No way in hell they could tell we were there. If we had better range, we could follow them all the way home.
Like that game the Germans played on us once upon a time. Send a bird right behind a returning raid and drop a few bombs right after they landed."
"We'd never get anything through their IFF," Toland replied.
"True, but we'd know their arrival time at their bases to within, 10 minutes. That's got to be useful to somebody."
Commander Toland set his cup down.
"Yeah, you're right."
He decided he'd put that idea on the printer to Commander Eastern Atlantic. Lammersdorf, Federal Republic of Germany. There was no mistaking it. NATO lines had been decisively broken south of Hanover. Two brigades were taken from the perilously thin NATO ground reserve and sent toward Alfeld. Unless this hole was plugged, Hanover would be lost, and with it all of Germany east of the Weser. Chapter 29 Remedies. Alfeld, Federal Republic of Germany. As predicted, the bridge lasted less than an hour. In that time, Alexeyev had gotten a full battalion of mechanized infantry across, and though the NATO troops launched a pair of vicious counterattacks on his bridgehead, the tanks he'd placed on the east bank had been able to break them up with direct fire. Now NATO had caught its breath and was assembling artillery. Heavy guns pounded his bridgehead and the tanks on the Soviet side of the river. And to make matters worse, the assault boats had been held up by incredible traffic snarls on the road between Zack and Alfeld. German heavy guns were littering the road and surrounding land with artillery-deployed mines, each powerful enough to knock the tread off a tank or the wheel off a truck. Sappers swept the roads continuously, using heavy machine guns to detonate the mines. But every one took time, and not all were seen before they exploded under a heavily loaded vehicle. The loss of the individual trucks and tanks was bad enough. Worse still were the traffic tie-ups that resulted from each disabled vehicle. Alexeyev's headquarters were in a camera shop overlooking the river. The plate glass window had long since been blown away, and his boots crackled with every step. He surveyed the far bank through his binoculars, and anguished for his men as they tried to fight back at the men and tanks on the hills above them. A few kilometers away, every mobile gun in 8th Guards Army was racing forward to provide fire support for his tank division, and he and Sergeyev set them to counter-battery the NATO guns. "Enemy aircraft!" a lieutenant shouted. Alexeyev craned his neck and saw a dot to the south, which grew rapidly into a German F-104 fighter. Yellow tracer lines reached out from his AA guns and blotted it from the sky before it could release. But instantly another appeared, this one firing its own cannon at the gun vehicle and exploding it. Alexeyev swore as the single-engine fighter bored in, dropped two bombs on the far side of the river, then streaked away. The bombs fell slowly, retarded by small parachutes. Then, 20 meters over the ground, appeared to fill the air with fog. Alexeyev dove to the floor of the shop as the cloud of explosive vapor detonated from the fuel-air explosive bombs. The shock wave was fearful, and above his head a display case shattered, dropping broken glass all over him. "What the hell was that?" Sergeyev yelled, deafened by the blast, then looking up. "You're hit, Comrade General!" Alexeyev ran his hand over his face. It came away red. His eyes stung, and he poured the contents of his canteen over his face to clear them of the blood. Major Sergeyev slapped a bandage on his general's forehead with only one hand, Alexeyev noticed. "What happened to you?" "I fell on some of this damned glass. Stay still, Comrade General. You're bleeding like a slaughtered cow." A lieutenant general showed up. Alexeyev recognized him as Viktor Beregovoy, 8th Guards Army's second in command. "Comrade General, you have orders to return to headquarters. I am here to relieve you." "The hell you say?" Alexeyev bellowed. "The orders come from Commander-in-Chief West, comrade. I am a general of tank troops. I can carry on here. If you will permit me to say so, you have performed brilliantly. But you are needed elsewhere." "Not until I'm finished." "Comrade General, if you want this crossing to succeed, we need more support here." "Who can better arrange that support, you or I?" Beregovoy asked reasonably. Alexeyev let out a long, angry breath. The man was right. But for the first time, Pavel Leonidovich Alexeyev had led, really led, men in combat. And he had done well. Alexeyev knew it. He had done well. "There is no time to argue. You have your task, and I have mine," the man said. "You know the situation?" "Fully. There is a vehicle in the back to return you to headquarters." Alexeyev held the bandage to his head. Sergeyev hadn't tied it properly, and walked out the back of the shop. Where the door had once been, he found a gaping hole. A BMD infantry carrier was there, its motor running. Alexeyev got in and found a medical orderly, who clucked over the general, and went immediately to work. As the carrier pulled off, Alexeyev listened to the noise of combat diminish. It was the saddest sound he had ever heard. Langley Air Force Base, Virginia. There was nothing like a distinguished flying cross to make a person happy about flying, and she wondered if she might be the first female Air Force pilot to have one. If not, Major Nakamura decided, what the hell? She had a gun camera videotape of all three of her badgers, and a Navy pilot she'd met in Brittany before catching a flight stateside had called her one damned fine pilot, for an Air Force puke. After which she had reminded him that if the dumbass Navy pilots had listened to her, maybe their airbase wouldn't be in a body and fender shop. Game, set, and match, she grinned, to Major Amelia Nakamura, USAF. All the F-15s that could be ferried across the Atlantic had been ferried, and now she had another job. Only four of the 48th Fighter Interceptor Squadron's Eagles were still at Langley. The rest were scattered up and down the East Coast, including the two pilots who were qualified for the ASAT anti-satellite missiles. As soon as she'd heard that, she had made a phone call and informed Space Command that she was the Eagle driver who had worked out the ASAT flight profile. And why take a combat pilot off the line when she could handle the mission very well, thank you? She checked to make sure the ugly missile was properly attached to the airframe. It had been taken out of secure storage and re-examined by a team of experts. Buns shook her head. There had only been one real test of the system before a moratorium had been slapped on the project. A successful test, to be sure, but only one. She hoped it would work. The Navy really needed help from the Air Force pukes. Besides, that A6 driver was cute. The Major finished her walk around, taking her time. Her target wasn't over the Indian Ocean yet. Then strapped herself into her Eagle, ran her eyes and hands over the gauges and handles, adjusted the seat, and finally input the numbers painted on the wall of the aircraft shelter into the aircraft's inertial navigation system so that the fighter would know where it was. Finished, she began to fire up her engines. Her flight helmet protected her from the shriek of the two Pratt & Whitney engines. The needles on her engine gauges rotated into proper position. Below her, the crew chief gave the aircraft a careful examination, then waved to her to taxi the aircraft into the open. Six people were out there, standing behind the red warning line to protect their ears from the noise. Always nice to have an audience, she thought, ignoring them. Eagle 104 ready to taxi, she told the tower. 104, roger, you are cleared to taxi, the tower controller replied. Wind is 253 at 12 knots. Roger that, 104 is rolling. Buns brought her canopy down. The crew chief snapped to attention and gave the Major a perfect salute. Nakamura answered it with panache, advanced her throttle slightly, and the Eagle fighter moved off to the runway like a crippled stork. A minute later, she was in the air, a silky smooth feeling of pure power enveloping her as she pointed her Eagle at the sky. Cosmos 1801 was just completing its southbound leg, bending around the Straits of Magellan to head north over the Atlantic. The orbital pass would take it 200 miles off the American coast. At the ground control station, technicians prepared to switch on the powerful sea surveillance radar. They were sure an American carrier battle group was at sea, but had been unable to locate it. Three regiments of backfires were waiting for information that would allow them to repeat the feat accomplished on the second day of the war. Nakamura eased her fighter under the tanker's tail, and the boom operator expertly shoved the refueling probe into the back of her fighter. 10,000 pounds of fuel transferred into her tanks in only a few minutes. And as she disengaged, a small cloud of kerosene vapor escaped into the sky. "Gulliver, this is 104, over," she called over the radio.
104, this is Gulliver," replied a colonel in the passenger compartment of a Learjet cruising at 40,000 feet.
"All tanked and ready to go. All onboard systems show green. Orbiting at Point Sierra. Ready to initiate intercept climb. Standing by."
"Roger that, 104.
Major Nakamura kept her Eagle in a small turning circle. She didn't want to waste a drop of fuel when she started her climb. She shifted ever so slightly in her seat, which, for her, was a violent show of emotion when flying, and concentrated on her aircraft. As her eyes traced over her cockpit instruments, she told herself to control her breathing. Space Command's radars picked up the Soviet satellite as it passed the bulge of South America. Computers compared its course and speed with known data, matched them with the position of Nakamura's fighter, and a computer spat out its commands, which were relayed to the Learjet.
104, come to heading 245.
Turning now.
The major brought her fighter into a tight turn.
Holding on 245.
Stand by.
Stand by.
Initiate.
Roger. Buns pushed her throttles to the stops and punched up the afterburners. The Eagle leaped forward like a spurred horse, accelerating through Mach 1 in seconds. Next, she eased back on the stick, bringing her Eagle into a 45-degree climb, still accelerating into a darkening sky. She didn't look out. Her eyes were locked on her cockpit gauges. The fighter had to maintain a specific flight profile for the next 2 minutes. As the Eagle rocketed into the sky, the altimeter needle whirled around its clock face. 50,000 feet. 60,000 feet. 70, 80, 90,000 feet. Stars were visible now in the nearly black sky, but Nakamura didn't notice.
"Come on, baby, find the son of a bitch," she thought aloud.
Beneath the aircraft, the ASAT missile's tracking head came on, searching the sky for the infrared heat signature of the Soviet satellite. A light blinked on Bunz's instrument panel. "My weapon is tracking. Repeat, my weapon is tracking. Auto-launch sequence equipment is activated. Altitude 94,000 feet, 700. Breakaway, breakaway." She felt her aircraft lurch as the heavy missile dropped free and immediately brought her throttles back to low power and brought the stick back to loop the fighter. She checked her fuel state. The afterburning climb had nearly emptied her tanks, but she had enough to make Langley without tanking again. She had already turned for home when she realized that she hadn't seen the missile. It didn't matter anyway. Nakamura turned west, letting the Eagle settle into a shallow dive that would terminate on the Virginia coast. Aboard the Learjet, a tracker camera followed the missile upward. The solid fuel rocket motor burned for 30 seconds, then the warhead separated. The miniature homing vehicle, an infrared heat sensor embedded in its flat face, had long since acquired its target. The Soviet satellite's onboard nuclear reactor radiated waste heat out into space, and the resulting infrared signature rivaled the sun. As its microchip brain computed the intercept course, the MHV made a tiny course alteration, and the distance between warhead and satellite dropped at a precipitous rate. The satellite was northbound at 18,000 miles per hour, the MHV southbound at over 10,000. Yet another high-tech kamikaze. Then,
"Jesus," said the senior officer on the Learjet, as he blinked his eyes and turned away from the TV screen.
Several hundred pounds of steel and ceramic had just turned to vapor.
"That's a kill. Say again, that's a kill."
The TV picture was downlinked to Space Command, where a radar picture backed it up. The massive satellite was now an expanding cloud of orbiting rubble.
"Target is negated," said a calmer voice.
Leninsk, Kazakh SSR.
The loss of signal from the Cosmos 1801 satellite was recorded scant seconds after it was obliterated from the sky. It was no surprise to the Russian space experts, since 1801 had used up its maneuvering thrusters several days before, and had been an easy target. Another F-1M rocket booster was sitting on a launch pad of the Baikonur Cosmodrome Complex. An abbreviated launch sequence countdown would be underway inside of 2 hours. But from now on, the ability of the Soviet Navy to locate convoys and fighting fleets would be in jeopardy. Langley Air Force Base, Virginia.
"Well?" Buns asked, as she jumped down from her fighter.
"Kill. We have it on tape," another major said. "It worked."
"How soon do you think they'll launch a replacement?"
"One more kill, and I'll be an ace."
"We think they have one on the pad now, 12 to 24 hours. No telling how many spares they have ready."
Nakamura nodded. The Air Force had a total of 6 remaining ASAT rockets. Maybe enough, maybe not. One successful mission did not make it a reliable weapon. She walked over to the squadron headquarters for coffee and donuts.
Stendal, German Democratic Republic.
"God damn it, Pasha," Cinquest swore. "I don't have a 4-star deputy so that he can run around playing divisional commander. Look at you. You might have got your head cut off."
"We needed a breakthrough. The tank commander was killed and his deputy was too young. I have given us the breakthrough."
"Where is Captain Sergeyev?"
"Major Sergeyev," Alexeyev corrected. "He performed well as my aide. His hand got carved up, and he's having it attended to."
"So, what reinforcements do we have moving to the 8th Guards Army?"
Both generals moved over to a large map.
"These 2 tank divisions are already en route, 10 to 12 hours. How firm is your bridgehead?"
"Could be better," Alexeyev admitted. "There were 3 bridges there, but some madman started dropping rockets into the town and wrecked 2 of them. That left 1. We managed to get a mechanized battalion across, along with some tanks, before the Germans were able to destroy it. They have plenty of artillery support, and when I left, we had boats and bridging equipment coming in. The man who relieved me will be trying to reinforce as soon as he can arrange a crossing in force."
"Opposition?"
"Thin, but the terrain is on their side. I'd estimate 1 regiment or so, the remains of other NATO units. Some tanks, but mainly mechanized infantry. They also have plenty of artillery support. When I left, it was a very even match. We have more firepower, but most of it's trapped on our side of the line. It's a race to see who can reinforce quickest."
"After you left, NATO threw aircraft in. Our people are trying to hold them back, but NATO seems to be ahead in the air."
"We can't wait for night. Those bastards own the night sky."
"Go now?"
Alexeyev nodded, thinking of what casualties he was bringing down on his division. "As soon as we can assemble the boats, expand the bridgehead to 2 kilometers, then get the bridges across. What's NATO bringing in?"
"Radio intercepts have identified 2 brigades en route, 1 British and 1 Belgian."
"They'll send more than that. They must know what we can do if we exploit this. We have 1st Guards Tank Army in reserve."
"Commit half of our reserves here?"
"I can't think of a better place."
Alexeyev gestured at the map. The drive toward Hanover had been stopped within sight of the city. The Northern Army groups had gotten into the outskirts of Hamburg at the cost of gutting 3rd Shock Army's tank formations. "With luck, we can break all of the 1st into the enemy rear. That will get us to the Weser, at least. Maybe the Rhine."
"A large gamble, Pasha," Cinquest breathed.
But the odds here were better than anything else on the map. If the NATO forces were stretched as thinly as his intelligence staff said, they had to crumble someplace. Perhaps this was it?
"Very well. Start posting the orders."
Faslane, Scotland.
"What about their ASW forces?
asked the captain of USS Pittsburgh.
Considerable. We estimate that Ivan has two major anti-submarine warfare groups, one centered on Kiev, the other on a Cresta cruiser. There are also four smaller groups, each composed of a Krivak-class frigate and 4 to 6 patrol frigates of the Grisha and Mirka type. Add to that a large collection of ASW aircraft, and finally 20 or so submarines, half-nuclear, half-conventional, answered the briefing officer.
Why don't we let them keep the Barents Sea, muttered Todd Sims of USS Boston.
There's an idea, Dan McCafferty agreed silently.
7 days to get there? Pittsburgh asked.
Yes, that gives us a good deal of freedom on how to enter the area. Captain Little?
The captain of HMS Torbay took the podium. McCafferty wondered if the Brits had any need for NFL-style nose guards in their team sports. Under 6 feet, but very broad across the shoulders, his head topped by a shock of sandy, unruly hair, James Little certainly looked like one. When he spoke, it was with toughly won assurance.
We've been running a campaign we call Key Punch. The objective of Key Punch is to evaluate what ASW defenses Ivan has operating in the Barents Sea. And also, of course, to lop off the odd Sov who gets in our way.
He smiled. Torbay had 4 kills.
Ivan's set a barrier from Bear Island to the coast of Norway. The immediate area around Bear Island is a solid minefield. Ivan's been laying the thing since he took the island by parachute assault 2 weeks ago. South of this area, so far as we can determine, the barrier is composed of some small minefields and Tango-class diesel subs as a front line, backed by the mobile ASW groups and Victor III-class nuclear submarines. Their aim appears to be not so much prosecute to kill as prosecute to drive off. Every time one of our submarines has made an attack on this barrier line, there has been a vigorous response. Inside the Barents, things are pretty much the same. These small hunter-killer groups can be bloody dangerous. I personally had an encounter with the Krivak and 4 Grishas. Inshore, they have helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft in direct support, and it was a most unpleasant experience. We also found several new minefields. The Soviets appear to be sowing them almost at random in water as deep as 100 fathoms. Finally, they seem to have set a number of traps. One of them cost us Trafalgar. They set a small minefield and placed a noisemaker within it that sounds exactly like a Tango snorkeling her diesels. As near as we can make out, Trafalgar moved in to collect the Tango and ran right into a mine. Something to keep in mind, gentlemen.
Little paused to let that bit of hard-won intelligence sink in.
Right. What we intend you chaps to do is head north-northwest towards the edge of the Greenland ice pack, then east along the edge of the pack to the Svitana Anna Trough. 5 days from today, 3 of our submarines will raise pure bloody hell on the barrier, supported by our own ASW aircraft and some fighters, if that can be arranged. That ought to get Ivan's attention and draw his mobile forces west. You should then be able to proceed south to your objective. It's a roundabout route, of course, but it enables you to use your towed sonars for the maximum period of time, and you should be able to run at relatively high speed at the edge of the ice pack without being detected.
McCafferty thought that one over.
The edge of the ice pack was a noisy place, with billions of tons of ice in constant movement. The route has been scouted by HMS Scepter and Superb. They encountered minor patrolling only. 2 Tangos were found in that area. Our chaps had orders not to engage. That told the Americans how important this mission was. They will be waiting for you, so do be careful about engaging something in your path.
How do we get out? Todd Sims wondered.
As quickly as you can. By that time, we should have at least 1 more submarine to assist you. They'll stay roughly 12 hours ahead of your estimate speed of advance, eliminating any opposition they find. Once you reach the ice pack, you're on your own. Our chaps will be there only as long as it takes to reach the pack. After that, they have other duties to perform. We expect that Ivan's ASW groups will come after you. No surprise there, is it?
We'll try to maintain pressure south of Bear Island to tie down as many as we can, but speed will be your best defense in this case. The skipper of USS Boston nodded. He could run faster than the Russians could hunt.
Further questions? Asked Commander, Submarines Eastern Atlantic.
Good luck, then. We'll give you all the support we can. McCafferty leafed through his briefing papers to check for the firing orders, then tucked the ops orders into his back pocket. Operation Doolittle. He and Sims left together. Their submarines were at the same quay. It was a short, quiet drive. They arrived to see Tomahawk missiles being loaded, in Chicago's case, into the 12 vertical tubes installed forward of the pressure hull in the submarine's bow. Boston was an older boat and had had to offload some of her torpedoes to make room for them. No submarine captain is ever happy offloading torpedoes.
"Don't worry, I'll back you up," McCafferty said.
"You do that. Looks like they're almost finished. Be nice to have one more beer, wouldn't it?" Sims chuckled.
"See you when we get back."
Sims and McCafferty shook hands. A minute later, both were below, seeing to the final arrangements for going back to sea. USS Farris. The Sikorsky Sea King helicopter was a tight fit on the frigate's helo deck, but for casualties the rules were always bent. The 10 worst cases, all scald burns and broken limbs, were loaded aboard after the helo was refueled, and Morris watched it lift off for the beach. The captain of what was left of USS Farris put his cap back on and lit another cigarette. He still didn't know what had gone wrong with that Victor class. Somehow the Russian skipper had teleported himself from one place to another.
"We killed three of the bastards, sir." Chief Clark appeared at Morris's side.
"Maybe this one just got lucky."
"Reading minds, Chief?"
"I beg pardon, sir. You wanted me to report on some things. The pumps have just about dried things out. I'd say we're leaking 10 gallons an hour at the crack on the lower starboard corner. Hardly worth talking about.
The bulkhead's holding, and we got people keeping an eye on it. Same story with the tow cable. Those tugboat guys know their stuff. The engineer reports both boilers are fully repaired, number two still online. The Prairie Masker is operating. The Sea Sparrow is working again in case we need that, but the radars are still down."
Morris nodded. "Thank you, Chief. How are the men?"
"Busy. Kind of quiet. Mad."
"That's one advantage they have over me," Morris thought. "They're busy."
"If you'll pardon me saying so, Skipper, you look awful tired," Clark said.
The bosun was worried about his captain, but had already said more than he was supposed to.
"We'll all get a good rest soon enough."
Sunnyvale, California. "We show one bird lifting off," the watch officer told North American Aerospace Defense Command. "Coming out of Baikonur Cosmodrome on a heading of 155, indicating a probable orbital inclination of 65 degrees. Signature characteristics say it's either an SS-11 ICBM or an F-1 type space booster."
"Only one?"
"Correct. One bird only." A lot of U.S. Air Force officers had suddenly become very tense. The missile was on a heading that would take it directly over the central United States in 40 to 50 minutes. The rocket in question could be many things. The Russian SS-9 missile, like many American counterparts, was obsolete and had been adapted as a satellite booster rocket. Unlike its American counterparts, it had been originally designed as a fractional orbital bombardment system, FOBS, a missile that could put a 25-megaton nuclear warhead into a flight path mimicking that of a harmless satellite. "Booster engine cutoff."
"Okay, we show separation and second-stage ignition," the colonel said on the phone.
The Russians would freak if they knew how good our cameras are, he thought. "Flight path continues as before." Already NORAD had flashed a warning to Washington. If this was a nuclear strike, National Command Authority was ready to react. So many current scenarios began with a large warhead exploded at orbital height over the target country, causing massive electromagnetic damage to communications systems. The SS-9 FOBS system was tailor-made for that sort of thing. Second stage cutoff. And there's third stage ignition. Do you copy our position, Fix NORAD?
That's a roger, acknowledged the general under Cheyenne Mountain.
The signal from the early warning satellite was linked into NORAD headquarters, and a watch crew of 30 was holding its breath, watching the image of the space booster move across the map projection.
Dear God, don't let it be a nuke.
Ground-based radar in Australia now tracked the vehicle, showing the climbing third stage and the spent second stage falling into the Indian Ocean. Their information also was linked by satellite to Sunnyvale and Cheyenne Mountain.
That looks like shroud release, the man in Sunnyvale said.
The radar picture showed four new objects fluttering away from the third stage. Probably the protective aluminum shroud needed for atmospheric flight, but unnecessary weight for a space vehicle. People began to breathe more regularly. A re-entry vehicle needed such a shroud, but a satellite did not. After 5 tense minutes, this was the first piece of good news. The FOBS didn't do that. An Air Force RC-135 aircraft was already lifting off the ground at Tinker Air Force Base, Oklahoma. Its engines firewalled as the flight crew raced the converted 707 airliner to altitude. The roof of what otherwise would be a passenger compartment held a large telescope camera assembly used to inspect Soviet space vehicles. In the back, technicians activated the sophisticated tracking systems used to lock the camera in on its distant target.
Burnout, they announced at Sunnyvale.
The vehicle has achieved orbital velocity. Initial numbers look like an apogee of 156 miles and a perigee of 148. They'd have to refine those numbers, but NORAD and Washington needed something right now.
Your evaluation? NORAD asked Sunnyvale.
Everything is consistent with a radar ocean reconnaissance satellite launch. The only change is the orbital intersection path was southerly instead of northerly, which made perfectly good sense, as everyone knew. Any kind of rocket launched over the pole entailed dangers that no one wanted to contemplate. 30 minutes later, they were sure. The crewman on the RC-135 got good pictures of the new Soviet satellite. Before it had completed its first revolution, it was classified as a RORSAT. The new radar ocean surveillance satellite would be a problem for the Navy, but not something to end the world. The people in Sunnyvale and Cheyenne Mountain maintained their vigil. Iceland. They followed a footpath around the mountain. Vigdis told them it was a favorite place for tourists to visit. A small glacier on the northern side of the mountain fed a half-dozen streams, which led in turn to a sizable valley full of small farms. They had a fine vantage point. Almost everything in sight was below them, including several roads that were kept under constant scrutiny. Edwards debated the advantages of cutting straight across the valley toward their objective or staying on the rough ground to the east.
"I wonder what kind of radio station that is," Smith said.
There was a tower of some sort 8 miles west of them. Mike looked at Vigdis and got a shrug. She didn't listen to the radio.
"Not easy to tell from this far," Edwards observed, "but probably they have some Russians."
He unfolded his big map. This part of the island showed lots of roads, but the information had to be taken with a grain of salt. Only two of the roads had decent surfaces. The rest were called seasonal on the map.
Meaning exactly what? Edwards wondered.
Of these, some were well maintained, others were not. The map didn't say which was which. All of the Soviet troops they'd seen on the ground were driving jeep-type vehicles, not the tracked infantry carriers they'd observed on the invasion day. A good driver in a 4x4 could go almost anywhere, however. How good were the Soviets at driving jeeps over broken ground?
So many things to worry about, Edwards thought. Edwards tracked his field glasses over the area to his west. He saw a twin-prop airliner lift off from a small airfield.
You forgot about that, didn't you? The Russians are using those puddle jumpers to ferry troops around.
Sarge, what do you think?
Might as well get a professional decision.
Smith grimaced. The choice was between physical danger and physical exhaustion.
Some choice, he thought. That's supposed to be why we have officers.
I'd at least have some patrols down there, Lieutenant. Lots of roads. Figure some checkpoints so they can keep an eye on the local folks.
Let's say that radio's a navigation beacon. It'll be guarded. Regular radio station will be guarded, too. All these farms?
What kind of farms, Miss Vigdis?
Sheep, some milk cows, potatoes, she answered.
So when the Ruskies are off duty, there'll be some wandering around to get some fresh food instead of their canned crap. We would, too. I don't much like it, Lieutenant.
Edwards nodded agreement. Okay, we head east. Just about out of food.
There's always fish.
Fastlane, Scotland. Chicago led the procession. A Royal Navy fleet tug had helped her away from the quay, and the American sub was heading out the channel at 6 knots. They were taking advantage of a window in Soviet satellite coverage. It would be at least 6 hours before another Russian reconnaissance satellite came overhead. Behind McCafferty came Boston, Pittsburgh, Providence, Key West, and Groton, at 2 mile intervals.
"What's the sounding?" McCafferty asked over the intercom.
570 feet.
Time. McCafferty ordered the lookouts below. The only ships in sight were aft. Boston was clearly visible, her black sail and twin diving planes gliding over the water like the angel of death.
That was apt enough, he thought.
The captain of USS Chicago made a final check of the control station atop the sail, then dropped down the ladder, pulling the hatch closed behind him. Another 25 feet and he was in the attack center, where he closed another hatch, turning the locking wheel as far as it would go.
"Straight board shut," the executive officer reported, going through the official litany that signified that the submarine was rigged for dive.
Submariners evolved checklists long before aviators discovered them. McCafferty checked the status boards himself, and so furtively did several others of the attack center crew. Everything was as it should be.
"Dive. Make your depth 200 feet, McCafferty ordered.
The submarine filled with the sound of rushing air and water, and the sleek black hull began her descent. McCafferty reviewed the chart in his head. 74 hours to the ice pack and turn east. 43 hours to Sviatana and turn south. Then came the really hard part.
Stendal, German Democratic Republic.
The Battle of Alfeld was turning into a living thing that ate men and tanks like a wolf eats rabbits. Alexeyev chafed at being 200 kilometers distant from the tank division he now regarded as his own. He could not complain about his relief, which only made things worse. The new commander had staged a successful forced river crossing, putting another 2 regiments of mechanized infantry on the far bank, and now 3 ribbon bridges were being built across the Lina. Or at least a spirited attempt was underway to build them, despite murderous artillery fire from NATO units.
"We have created a meeting engagement, Pasha," Cinquest said, staring down at the map.
Alexeyev nodded agreement. What had begun as a limited attack was fast becoming the focal point of the whole fighting front. 2 more Soviet tank divisions were now near the battle area, racing to the Lina. 3 NATO brigades were known to be heading the same way, along with artillery. Both sides were pulling tactical fighters from other sectors, one to smash the bridgehead, the other to support it. The terrain at the front didn't give the SAM crews enough time to discriminate friend from foe. The Russians had many more surface-to-air missiles, and so a free-fire zone had been established at Alfeld. Anything that flew was automatically a target for the Russian missiles, while Soviet aircraft kept clear, working instead to locate and kill NATO artillery and reinforcements. That ran contrary to pre-war doctrine. Another gamble, but a favorable one, Alexeyev judged, given his experiences at the front. That was an important lesson not stressed enough in pre-war training. Senior commanders had to see what was happening with their own eyes. How did we ever forget that? Pasha wondered. He fingered the bandage on his forehead. Alexeyev was suffering from a murderous headache, and a doctor had used 12 stitches to close the wound. Crude stitches, the doctor had told him. They would leave a scar. His father had several such scars, all worn with pride. He'd accept the decoration for this one. "We have the ridge north of the town," 20th Tanks commander called in. "We've pushed the Americans off." Alexeyev took the phone. "How soon on the bridges?" "We ought to have one ready in another half hour. Their artillery support is slackening off. They blew one bridging unit to hell, but this one will be completed. I have a battalion of tanks lined up already. The SAMs are doing well. I can see the wreckage of 5 aircraft from where I'm standing. I see..." The general was interrupted by man-made thunder. Alexeyev could do nothing but stare at the telephone receiver. His fist tightened in anger around the handset. "Excuse me, that was close. The final section of bridge is rolling out now. Those engineers have taken terrible losses, Comrade General. They deserve particular attention. The major in command of the unit has been exposed for 3 hours now. I want the gold star for him." "Then he'll get it." "Good. Good. The bridge section is off the truck and in the water. If they give us 10 minutes to anchor the far end, I'll get those damn tanks across for you. How long on my reinforcements?" "The lead elements will arrive just after sunset." "Excellent. I must leave now. I'll be back when we start rolling tanks." Alexeyev handed the phone back to a junior officer. It was like listening to a hockey game on the radio. "The next objective, Pasha?" "Northwest to Hameln and beyond. We might be able to cut off NATO's northern army groups. If they start to disengage their forces around Hamburg, we go to a general attack and chase them all the way to the English Channel. I think we have the situation we've been hoping for." Brussels, Belgium. At NATO headquarters, staff officers looked at the same maps and reached the same conclusions with less enthusiasm. Reserves were dangerously low. Yet there was no choice. Men and guns converged on Alfeld in ever-increasing numbers. Panama. It was the biggest transit of U.S. Navy ships in years. The gray hulls used both sides of each lock system, preventing westbound traffic from moving. They were in a hurry. Helicopters moved the canal pilots to and from ships. Speed restrictions were broken, regardless of the erosion problems at the Gilliard Cut. Those ships needing refueling had it done as soon as they exited the canal at the Gatun Locks, then formed an anti-submarine barrier outside Limon Bay. The formation's transit from Pacific to Atlantic lasted 12 hours under ruthless security. Finished, they departed north at a fleet speed of 22 knots. They had to go through the Windward Passage at night. Chapter 30. Approaches. Boston, Massachusetts. "They call it the smell of the sea," Morris thought. "But really it's not. It's the smell of land." It came from the tidal marshes, all the things that lived and died and rotted at the water's edge. All the smells that fermented in the marginal wetlands, and when released, blew out to sea. Sailors considered it a friendly odor because it meant that land, port, home, family were near. Otherwise, it was something to be neutralized with Lysol. As Morris watched, the tug Papago shortened her towline for better control in the restricted waters. 3 harbor tugs came alongside, their crews throwing messenger lines to the frigate's sailors. When they were secured, Papago cast off and proceeded up the river to refuel.
"Good afternoon, Captain."
The harbor pilot had come out on one of the tugs. He looked to have been bringing ships in and out of Boston for 50 years.
"And to you, Captain," Morris acknowledged. "I see you killed 3 Russian subs."
"Only one by ourselves. The others are assists."
How much water are you drawing forward?
Just under 25 feet.
No, Morris had to correct himself. The sonar dome was at the bottom of the Atlantic now.
You did well to bring her back, Captain, the pilot said, looking forward.
My can didn't survive. Before you were born, I guess. Callahan, 792. Assistant gunnery officer. I just made JG. We got 12 Jap planes, but just after midnight, the 30th kamikaze got through on us. 47 men. Well.
The pilot took the walkie-talkie from his pocket and started giving directions to the tugs. Ferris began to move sideways toward a pier. A medium-sized dry dock was straight ahead, but they were not moving that way.
Not the dry dock? Morris asked, surprised and angry that his ship was being moved to an ordinary pier.
Mechanical problems in the dock. They're not ready for you yet. Tomorrow, day after for sure.
I know how you feel, Captain, like your kid's hurt and they won't let her in the hospital.
Cheer up. I watched mine sink.
It made no sense to grumble, Morris knew. The man was right. If Ferris hadn't sunk during the tow, she was safe enough alongside the pier for a day or two. The pilot was an expert. His trained eye measured the wind and the tide, and he gave the proper orders to the tug captains. Within 30 minutes, the frigate was secured to the cargo pier. 3 TV news crews were waiting for them behind a screen of sailors in shore patrol livery. As soon as the brow was rigged, an officer hurried aboard and came right to the bridge.
"Captain, I'm Lieutenant Commander Anders. I have this for you, sir."
He handed over an official-looking envelope.
Morris tore it open and found a standard Navy dispatch form. The message ordered him in terse Navy prose to Norfolk by the quickest available transport.
"I have a car waiting. You can catch the shuttle to D.C., then hop a short hauler to Norfolk."
"What about my ship?"
"That's my job, Captain. I'll take good care of her for you."
Just like that, Morris thought.
He nodded and went below to pack his gear. 10 minutes later, he walked without speaking past the TV cameras and was taken to Logan International Airport.
Stornoway, Scotland. Toland went over the satellite photographs of Iceland's 4 airfields. Strangely, the Russians were not making any use of the old Keflavik field, preferring instead to base their fighters at Reykjavik and the new NATO base. Occasionally, a backfire or two were landing at Keflavik, bombers with mechanical problems or running short of fuel, but that was it. The northerly fighter sweeps had had their effect, too. The Russians were doing their tanking farther north and east now, which had produced a marginal but nevertheless negative effect on the backfire's range. The experts estimated that it cut 20 minutes off the time they had to search for convoys. Despite the searching done by the Bears and satellite reconnaissance, only 2/3 of the raids actually launched attacks. Toland didn't know why. Was there a problem with Soviet communications? If so, could they find a way to exploit it? The backfires were still hurting the convoys, and badly. After considerable Navy prodding, the Air Force was starting to base fighters in Newfoundland, Bermuda, and the Azores. Supported by tankers borrowed from the Strategic Air Command, they were trying to maintain a combat air patrol over those convoys they could reach. There was no hope of actually breaking up a backfire raid, but they could start thinning the Bears out. The Soviets had only about 30 of the wide-ranging Bear D reconnaissance aircraft. Roughly 10 flew every day with their powerful big-bulge radars turned on to guide the bombers and submarines in on the convoys, which made them relatively easy to find, if a fighter could be put out there to find them. After much experimentation, the Russians had fallen into a predictable pattern of air operations. They would be made to pay for that. Tomorrow, the Air Force would have a 2-plane patrol over 6 different convoys. The Russians would be made to pay a toll for basing aircraft on Iceland, too.
"I make it a regiment, say 24 to 27 aircraft, all MiG-29 fulcrums," Toland said. "We never seem to see more than 21 on the ground. I figure they're running a fairly steady combat air patrol, say 4 birds aloft almost around the clock. They also appear to have 3 ground-based radars, and they're moving them around a lot. That probably means that they're set up for ground-controlled intercepts.
Any problem jamming the search radars?
A fighter pilot shook his head.
With the right support, no.
So we'll just have to flush the MiGs off the ground and kill some.